Hi there and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado to today's episode. Neil Skeffington is the CEO and founder of Mead-based Novelplast, an innovative PET plastic recycling company. Beginning operations in late 2019, Neil's passion for sustainability in plastics and developing the circular economy has grown the company's sales into a diverse range of industries, employing 60 people and becoming the largest PET recycling plant in Ireland by some distance. Neil has spent his career in the PET manufacturing industry both in Ireland and abroad before setting his sights on developing recycling solutions for some of the world's problem plastic materials. Novelplast's vision is to be the world leader in improving the sustainability of plastics by developing technologies that add value and create a better environment for the future generations. Their process is leading the change in how polyester material is recycled and repurposed. They save thousands of tons of post-industrial and post-consumer PET materials from landfill per year. The materials are cleaned and pelletized, and a unique blend of additives is used to improve the mechanical and aesthetic properties of the end product, resulting in a viable alternative to using virgin PET material. Neil was EI Entrepreneur of the Year finalist in 2023. Neil, befalcha rose.
If anyone ever asks me what we do, I'm going to say phone Aidan, because he can do it better than I can.
Now, the Befalcha Road bit will come up in a second as to why I made that, but you graduated from Polymer Engineering at AIT, so take us on a whistle-stop tour of what happened next before then getting back to Novelplast.
Yeah, so when I left school, we had a bit of a nomadic childhood. My father was in the bank, so we used to get moved around quite a lot back in the day. And even in university, I went to Queen's for a year to study mechanical engineering. Didn't really like it, and then ended up doing polymer engineering because my parents had just moved to Athlone. And I liked chemistry. Didn't know much about plastics at the time, so I thought this might have been a good career choice for me. So I studied that in Athlone, came away with a bachelor's degree, and at that time, it was 2002 when I graduated, everyone in my class was going into the construction industry because that's where all the big bucks were, you know. And I decided I would stick to what I stay in your lane, as they say. And I went into the plastics industry. And really, I've been in it since. I've worked my way through the value chain in PET. So I'm kind of a one trick pony in the plastics world. But it's not a bad trick. So I've worked in the packaging industry, producing the food trays that you get in your supermarkets, and the fiber industry, producing materials that end up in textiles or clothing or carpets. There's a whole range of areas that it ends up. Worked in the virgin manufacturing side of it out in the Middle East for about 7 years, and I think all over that time there was a slow realization, kind of like when you're boiling a frog. Not that I've boiled a frog, but as the analogy goes, that hardly anything that I was making was ever getting recycled. And even when I look back on my time in college, I don't think we spent 1 hour learning how to recycle the plastics that we were learning every day how to make. So it's quite a new industry from that respect, and because people didn't really think about it, they were just thinking about make. It was a linear economy, and I came away from my time in the Middle East with some ideas about how to do my bit, I suppose, for the plastics world. Because if we don't start looking after plastics a bit better, they're not going to be sustainable. When people think of plastics, you typically think of bottles or what you bring home from the supermarket. But it's everywhere. You know, you're wearing it, you're sitting on it, the carpet, the furniture, the nappies you put on your children. It's literally just we're surrounded by it. It's a very ubiquitous material that we need to find ways of dealing with. So as a polymer engineer, I suppose, and I was never the best polymer engineer in college, but I tried to find methods to deal with materials that don't get recycled at the moment. Mm-hmm. So that's what we've done in Novelplast. My journey to entrepreneurship is probably, you know, I was never the best employee, so it was either unemployment or self-employment for me. Because
would you say you're an accidental entrepreneur then in that case?
I wouldn't say so, because when people say, you know, did you always think you'd be an entrepreneur? Mm. And I didn't.
Yeah.
I don't even like the word entrepreneur, to be honest with you, because there's a lot of connotations with it, you know, and people think it's quite a highfalutin career choice, you know, but it's like, it's entrepreneurship is hard work. It's mm-hmm. knuckling down. It's putting in the 7 day weeks and the 16 hour days to try and fix the problems that come at you on a daily basis, you know. But then when I look back in school, I was always tricking around. I was in boarding school. I was sneaking out to get cigarettes for the rest of the school and keeping one out of every 10. So there was always
a penny to be made, a deal to be done.
Yeah. So I was always looking for the easier option. But
it's interesting. I when we've seen a lot of the entrepreneurs on this podcast, and there is that kind of a belief that you know, they're kind of into two camps. There are those, as you say, I'm an entrepreneur, and they go and try to find a business to justify being an entrepreneur. And then there's others, and I think you fall into this one, where you saw a problem, you came up with a solution that just happened to be a very good business and as a result.
Yeah. There's a huge problem with in terms of circularity, not just in Ireland, but everywhere. And I suppose my expertise being in plastics and being in PET, It was a logical enough step for me. Raising money for it is a whole different animal in Ireland, you know. But I stuck at it for a couple of years to get it over the line, and here we are. Like, the business model itself has changed a lot since I first came up with the concept. You know, the different types of materials we're recycling, where we're going to get the materials from. We import materials from all over the world at the moment, you know, which was never the vision, but we constantly have to innovate and find new ways of recycling new types of materials. So every day is a bit different in our place. And it's a difficult enough work environment as well, because, like, what I tell people, like, in a normal work environment, you need to take the same raw materials every day to make the same product.
Yeah.
Whereas we need to make the same product every day out of different raw materials with variances in them. So it's quite a difficult path, and the staff quite often ask me, would I not have chosen something a little bit easier? But sure.
And when you look at it, I suppose the we kind of covered the why plastic recycling, but why Ireland, and then more importantly, coming back to the Irish bit, why the Gaeltacht area and me?
Okay, so Ireland, I wanted to come home from the Middle East.
Okay.
And in Ireland, we're terrible recyclers.
Okay.
So those two points probably made it a good place to start. We talk a good game in Ireland, but we're bottom of the table when it comes to circularity in Europe. I think something about 2.5% of the materials that we consume end up being circular, so end up either getting recycled or reused or repaired or refurbished or whatever it might be. So we're coming from a very low base. There are very few of us recyclers in Ireland, even though every bin truck you see going around the country says recycling on the side of it. Quite a lot of what we generate in Ireland goes to incineration or SRF, which would be to fire cement plants. There's so much that can be done in this area, and we're just doing a small part of it. So we'll recycle about 20,000 tons, which is a huge amount of plastic this year, and we're not even scratching the surface on it. Most of my materials come from outside of Ireland because people don't look after the materials well enough in Ireland.
That the materials aren't being used in Ireland, it's just they're not being recycled properly.
They haven't been recycled, yeah. A lot of the better stuff would be exported to recyclers outside of Ireland. But that is going to change. There's a new EU Circular Economy Act that's coming down the track in August this year, and it's going to put more onus on member states to be more self-sufficient in terms of recycling. So hopefully we're ahead of the game, and we're in a good position to take advantage of some of this stuff. There's some very interesting projects that we're looking at in the circular economy space, because it's such an early stage in the recycling technology journey. Mm-hmm. It's a European industry. It was developed in Europe probably about 20 years ago. But as I said, there are so many items, like, as I said, when we think of recycling, we think of bottles. Mm. But how are we going to recycle all the textiles? You go into Pennies and these places, yeah. like the shelves are just full, and that's all plastic, what you're looking at in there. And we need to find ways of dealing with that, because at the moment, it's most of it is ending up in Africa and just being burnt.
And on that point, basically, like you said, 20,000 tons of plastic you're going to recycle this year. Is all of that coming from Ireland?
No.
No.
Only a small percentage of it comes from Ireland.
Right.
Less than 20%.
Okay.
I would love to bring it all from within Ireland, but the collection streams and the sorting streams are just not there in Ireland. And we can, like, we can take material from South America, from Mexico, from the US, where people look after the materials a bit better. They're cleaner, they're better sorted. So we bring them in and we find ways to recycle those. But we focus on the more challenging materials.
Right.
So materials that are byproducts from other recycling plants that they don't know what to do with. So we'll bring them in. We have a big sorting process in the plant where we can sort out the different polymers ourselves, and that then feeds into our production lines. We might blend five or six different types of material together just to make the one product that's suitable for either to manufacture fiber or to manufacture packaging or automotive parts. Our product ends up in so many places. We're probably in every house in Ireland at the moment. We're in your fridge, either in your meat packaging, your mushroom punnets, your fruit punnets. Nearly all those in Ireland have, if not all of them actually, if they're not imported, have at least 30% material from us.
Right.
We're in your mattresses, your duvets, your pillows, so we're keeping you warm and cozy at night. We're in your car parts and the carpet in your car. If you drive certain types of cars, we're in the carpet because we supply quite a few of the fiber plants around Europe. Okay. We're in other car parts as well. So like we're constantly finding new markets for our product. And that's what's needed. It's, you know, the industry needs a bit of innovation to try and develop these new markets for recycled plastic, because not all of it, when we think of bottles getting recycled back into bottles, that's fine, but not all of it's suitable to go back into what it came from. And it might not always be the best solution for it either.
But then, you know, in terms of managing the business, then you've got huge variability in terms of the inputs that are going in. You have huge variability in terms of the outputs that are going out. So you must have a very agile production system to be able to.
Some days we do. And a lot of that, I suppose, the early days were horrific trying to start up the business in 2019. It took about 3 months to get the process right. And I brought in experienced process technicians to run the extruder. But like the reality was very different, because, like, typically when somebody is running an extruder, extruding plastic, they're using 100% virgin, or they're using a very consistent material, whereas we're firing all sorts into the extruder and we have to try and make a consistent product out of that. Right. So we have product specs that we work to for each of our customers, and we put a blend together every day that allows us to make that.
But it's a different blend every day, because what you're putting into the hopper is very, very different.
Yep. Every single day, our blend is different in there. So, and we operate 24 hours a day, 5.5 days a week. We'll probably in the next 5 to 6 months, we'll go to 24/7 just to keep up with demand.
Is demand that high?
It is, yeah. The market's like, anytime I meet somebody and I tell them what I'm doing, they're like, Jesus, it must be a great time to be a recycler. Yeah. But like there's so many cycles in the market. Like the price of virgin has dropped through the floor in the last 6 months. And while people talk a good sustainability game, if the price of virgin plastic drops, that's what they reach for, you know. Yeah. So we have to compete with that price, even though our cost structure is completely different. So I wouldn't, like, it's a difficult market at the moment. So we, as I said, we started in 2019. March. It took us 3 months to get our act together and get the process right. March 2020, no point in going over that, but we had to close the factory for 2 months whenever COVID arrived. We came through that. And COVID was actually quite good for us in a way, because it forced us to look at new markets and look at new raw material types. And then we went into the Ukraine war, so the price of energy went through the roof. We're quite a high energy user. So we had that to deal with, and then the market tanked as well. And then it came back up, and now it's after tanking again in the last 6 months. So it's a roller coaster of a journey trying to run the business. Now, I do think help is on its way from Europe, because the recyclers are really struggling, you know. So
and from a policy perspective, would it be, you know, what would be the bigger benefit for you if policy turned around and made the input side better or more efficient, or, you know, if they certainly turned around and said you have to recycle stuff this way, or if on the other side the policy turned around and mandated that you had to use a minimum of X amount of recycled plastic in whatever you're producing?
So legislation is there already to say you have to have 25% recycled content in your packaging.
Okay.
But in typical EU fashion, there was all carrot, no stick.
Right.
They never knew how they were going to police it. So the price of virgin started dropping, and people just started using virgin plastic again. And also how they counted is not right either, and different countries have different interpretations of it, which is typical in Europe. But they are going to fix it. You know, I think they're very aware that there are problems with the system. Mm-hmm. They plan to increase it to 30%, which is good, because I mean, what it does, if they find the right way to police it, is it breaks that link between virgin and recycled, and recycled won't become, or won't be a nice to have anymore. It'll be a must have.
Yeah.
So they'll have to go out to the market, and because there's not enough recycling capacity out there, we think, in Europe to even hit that 25% across the board.
Okay.
Yeah. So it should be a good time to be doing what I'm doing, but it's a tough market, you know.
And in terms of your ability then to scale the manufacturing within where you are now, have you the space to do it?
So getting back to the Gaeltacht, so we're located in the Gaeltacht in County Meath, little known Gaeltacht.
I never knew it. I didn't know.
Yeah, there's two small Gaeltachts in County Meath. So we got investment from Údaráis na Gaeltacht at the very start, and they had this big old derelict premises. And I had this romantic idea of recycling an old building as well, which comes with its problems. But we have about 50,000 square feet under roof at the moment. We have a few acres out the back as well. But there are other projects within Ireland that are probably much, much bigger than that we're looking at them at the moment. One of them is incredibly big, and we're looking for a 30 or 40 acre site at the moment to do that on.
Okay.
Can't say too much details about it, but it's a project that's so big it will reimagine what the circular economy is in Ireland.
Okay.
And with some big partners already on board for that. So I have to stay positive about the future of recycling, you know. So we have a bit of space to grow at the back. There are other projects coming up in Ireland with the bottle recycling. So they're obviously going through the deposit return scheme at the moment. And they are going to look for somebody to recycle those on the island of Ireland this year. So hopefully we'll be part of that, or somebody we know will be part of that we could partner up with.
You wonder why they set up something that's obviously been as successful as the bottle return is and not tried to keep it in house from the very start.
They kind of rushed it.
Okay.
So I think Eamon Ryan wanted a win that he could have whenever he retired. So it was kind of rushed, but it has worked quite well actually, and the recovery rate's probably about 70%, which isn't too bad for the first couple of years of operation. There is another small PET recycler in Ireland that recycles bottles, but they can't get them back into food grade, which are suitable for bottles for Coca-Cola. So that's why they'll look to build
a dedicated plant for it. Going back to the process of that awful word being entrepreneur, but let's say just starting the business, right? You have to wear an awful lot of hats when you start a business, and there's a kind of belief an awful lot of entrepreneurs think they need to be good at all of those hats, and it's just not possible.
Yeah.
You know?
like there's a lot of self-learning, even like going back to when you're starting to raise money and you're having to come up with cash flow projections and P&Ls and balance sheets and you know, you like, it'd be great to farm it out to an accountant to do it all for you, but reality is you probably just don't have the money to do it, you know. So from that respect, a lot of that was self-learned. Running the business itself, like I'm an engineer. I love being on the production line. I love being on the lab. And now we have throughout the plant, we've obviously a few people in finance, we've a few people in HR, we've supply chain, we have procurement. So you have to be a little bit good at all of them. You've had to learn, like you do or die when you're an entrepreneur and when you're all in, like I was. I didn't really have a choice. I had to, and that's why you do. That's why you do those late nights in the plant, because there's always problems. And, you know, when you're running your own business, and some people make it look easier than others, but it's not easy for anyone, really. You know,
well, particularly when you're running the plant 24 hours a day, you have no off time.
Tell me about it.
The phone goes off at 3 a.m. on bus. Does. We've a problem.
We have a good the notifications on my phone are blocked after 11 o'clock. And there's only three people who are not blocked, and one of them is a new process technician we have in the plant. Okay. So whenever he's on night shift, because he's very curious, you know, and he'll ask questions, and if I'm awake, I'll answer him. Yeah. There's always something to do or something going wrong somewhere that you need to deal with, you know.
The business has two main revenue streams. There's Revive and Renew. Tell us about them, the two of them. Where they fit.
Yeah, so Revive is our trademark. So all the pellets that we make from materials that we procure, we sell them under a trademark. I'm hoping someday that trademark is going to be worth some money. So that would be nice. So it's a nice idea, because the products we recycle don't get recycled if we don't take them, most of them. A lot of them end up in incineration, so we like to think we're reviving them back into something that ends up in your fridge or wherever, or your bed. And then the Renew side, so we work with a lot of our customers to take their waste material, and we bring their waste material to our site. We turn it back into a pellet that they can reuse, and then we'll send that back to them. So that's where the Renew side of it comes. Whenever the market's as cheap as it is, it's a difficult sell for them, because there's obviously transport costs and everything else involved in it. But
how would they get rid of it if they didn't? If you weren't taking it,
sometimes it's cheaper just to get rid of it. Yeah. And that's one of the problems here in Ireland. Whenever it comes to the circular economy, is there's no incentive to do the right thing.
Yeah.
There's typically the waste companies, and this is like, I'm not sticking the boot into them. I could, but I won't. But they're doing what they've been doing for years, which was collecting the waste, trying to sort some of it, incinerating a lot of it, and trying to find markets outside of Ireland, because the infrastructure is not there. Mm-hmm. Ireland pays fines, I think, of over 200 million a year for not recycling enough plastic. And it's, I don't understand how the government doesn't say...
Well, even if they took 10% of the 200 grand...
A year, and
rolled it back into a recycling industry.
It would pay for itself in no time at all. I just don't understand it. It's like the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. Hopefully that's going to change, because it's going to get more and more difficult. Yeah. You're going to have to be more self-sufficient on the island. Like all of our waste plastic used to go to China, pretty much all of it. They closed the door because they were having too much. But there was other countries in Asia like Vietnam and Indonesia. They closed the door as well. And then the EU banned exports to Asia of plastic waste. They have other markets. Africa takes a lot of our waste still. And a lot of the textile waste ends up getting burnt in landfills. The EU is aware of it and they're trying to deal with it. But we need to be more responsible. We need to educate people a bit better, because I think that's a missing piece. In Ireland, we have this nice ideal where we think we wash out our packaging and put it into the green bin, that it's going to a nice place where it's going to be recycled into something new. And that's not the case most of the time, unfortunately. Right. Yeah.
And do you think it's just then an education process for people that like, you know, is there that much more people have to do with their plastic at home that would make it be recyclable?
It's not so much the people at home. It's the systems that are in place and the lack of infrastructure. And sometimes it's cheaper for them to just incinerate the plastic. So I do a lot of work in schools with kids where I go out and I talk to them about sustainability and the circular economy and talk to them about plastics. And I always start by asking the room, and there could be 150, 200 kids in the room, what do they think of plastics? Are plastics good or plastics bad? And 99% of them will say plastics are bad, yet they're surrounded in them, you know, and they're such an important part of our lives. But then by the end of it, I like to think I've educated them on the circular economy and sustainability and how they should look after the materials a bit better. And by the end of it, they all love plastics. They're all fascinated by it, you know. So maybe more work in schools is required to embarrass the government into doing more or to embarrass maybe the waste companies into doing more. I don't know what the answer is, but certainly education needs to be part of it. Like even with the rollout of the deposit return scheme, the communication was terrible around it, you know. They just thought, half of Twitter thought that this is just a tax and it's the big guys up in Dublin who are trying to tax us more and it's not fair and we're already recycling our green bins. And really, if they were a bit braver about it, they would have come out and said, like, do you know, guys, what's going into your green bin is not really getting recycled properly.
Yeah.
This is going to guarantee that these bottles will turn back into bottles and will be fully circular. Yeah. And you wouldn't have got everyone on board because Twitter is a bit of a cesspit anyway, but at least people who didn't understand and are semi-normal, they would have started to understand why we did this, you know? And it's not a tax. If you bring the bottles back, you get your money back. It's pretty simple, you know?
But like, there's no reason why, when you think about some of the other food packaging, like you said, your mushrooms or your fruit things and things like that, that you couldn't do exactly the same thing as you do for plastic bottles and then just tell people, listen, don't put them into your green bin, just put them in a bag and bring them down, and there's another machine right beside your plastic bottle machine at your supermarket and in they go.
Yep. So it's like there are countries that are further ahead than others. In Norway, I was there a couple of months ago, and they have built a super recycling plant, which is basically this huge plant where all this mixed plastic goes in and they sort it out to within an inch of its life. So every fraction of plastics in every colour is sorted out into their different fractions, and all that material then goes on for further recycling back into pellets or for chemical recycling or whatever it might be. But that's where we need to get to in Ireland, really, to give it a chance of being recycled. Not all of it will be able to be recycled, but if you manage 70-80% it's huge, you know, from where we are right now.
Any sort of an increase, it improves. What's the culture in Novaplast?
On night shift or day shift?
Depending on what the production line is doing on the day.
So I obviously started the business with this idealistic vision of improving the sustainability of plastics. We do try and instill a culture of sustainability into the business. But the hardest part about running businesses these days, and you ask most entrepreneurs, they'll tell you the same, as people. Do you know, it's very difficult. There is a revolving door, especially in the recycling world, where you're like, we have a lot of engineers working in the place, but we also have general operators and assistant process technicians, and they'll head next door for an extra 10 cents an hour. There's no loyalty there whatsoever, you know. So it has been difficult to maintain that culture of sustainability. We do quite a lot of work on the CSR side of things. So that might be going out to schools. We organise beach cleanups where we'll pay for schools for their buses to go to the beaches. We've been to Betty's Town a few times, Termonfeckin Beach, Clarehead, where we'll bring them out and we'll clean the beaches for 2 hours and we bring all the waste back, and then we talk to them about the different waste streams and where they come from and how to be a bit better about how we look after our waste. So we'd like to think we're giving back, and I suppose like part of my thing is that the more, the better we do in business and the more money we make in business allows me to do more of that work in the community or with schools and educating people on what it takes to do a better job and what it means when you don't dispose of your waste properly. Do you know, it ends up in oceans and then it ends up in your beaches and it ends up fish eating them and you know, so we've a long way to go on it.
Yeah. The level of innovation in the business, you know, like obviously, you know, the science is changing all the time, so there's that bit. You know, when you look at it you know, is there greater innovation in the in trying to sort the inputs out or the actual production as you look at for the business?
Probably the inputs.
Okay.
So we have when I first started there, we had this small lab with a couple of machines in it, and we've invested over €500,000 in that over the last 4 or 5 years. So we've huge machines in there. We can replicate what our customers do. We put a huge amount of work into getting new types of materials into the plant that we can then try and find a recycling solution for. So that's where most of the innovation comes. We test all our finished products, obviously, to make sure it's within spec for what our customers want. But that's more the day-to-day work. The innovation is on the incoming materials.
Right.
We've also done quite a bit of work. So I get distracted by shiny things quite readily.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, like, because with success always comes the risk of distraction these things, you know.
I'm quite self-aware and I know that I get distracted. And I suppose there's shiny things and then there's wanting to find solutions for different types of materials. And also we developed a chemical recycling technology a few years ago. And it was funded through the Disruptive Technologies Innovation Fund through Enterprise Ireland. We did it in conjunction with a couple of universities in Ireland. And it was a really exciting project, and it was with a view to recycling textiles. Needs money spent on it, and whenever we got it to that point where it needed a lot of money spent on it, the market started to fall for recycled plastic. So it's parked for the minute, but it's a nice technology. We also did an innovation project through the Department of Environment that was to recycle fishing gear. So you go to any fishing port in Ireland, you'll see mountains of fishing nets everywhere. So we did a project to recycle all the fishing gear in Greencastle. And we tried to add, because if you're just like most of the fishing gear is made from HDPE, which is polyethylene. And if you're just a polyethylene recycler, there's more of them out of business than there are in business at the moment. So we tried to find a way to valorize that. And what we ended up doing was developing a system with a company down in Cork that had blockchain technology for traceability, a company called Verifact. And we were able to recycle the fishing gear back into a pellet, and on the bag then we would put a QR code to give traceability back to which boat the fishing gear came from. Will everyone pay for such technology? No, but some companies will. You know, we had a lot of interest in it from car companies in the US, big innovative car companies. But then, you know, we hit roadblocks along the way with some government bodies. I won't name them, but they wanted us to start tendering for the fishing gear if we wanted to recycle it. And we were tendering against people who were incinerating it. So, you know, it just wasn't worth it for us. Is it going to happen? It will happen. And we like to think we'd be at the top of the queue, and it does happen because we've all the research done on it. And there's new rules and regulations around fishing gear and EPR, which is your extended producer responsibility scheme, like your repack for packaging. Yeah. So that's coming down the track for fishing gear. So it will remove that that kind of, I suppose it's a grey area where we have to compete with waste companies who can just send it for incineration and be done with it. Because recycling is expensive. It's an expensive process. There's nothing simple about it. So we hope that in the future we'll be in a better position to recycle some of these materials.
But is it always the case, though, when you look at it, the problem of the virgin stuff and the price of the virgin stuff is always going to be there, because there's just so much of it. Like, so, you know, it's not a finite resource, the virgin peat.
But it shouldn't be a choice in certain markets.
Okay.
If it's like, obviously in medical device, you don't want recycled plastic in your medical device if it's going in your arm or in a stent or something, you know. So where it can be used in your packaging or in textiles or wherever it might be, then it shouldn't be a choice. And some countries have moved already. In Spain, they put a tax on virgin plastics of 450 euros a ton. So it breaks that link between virgin plastic and recycled plastic. And it works, you know. So hopefully there are measures coming down the track quite quickly that will allow us to do that. But there are still a lot of hurdles. Like another innovative or innovation project that we did was, it was funded through a group called Circulera. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of them. They're part of Irish Manufacturing Research. And it's all to do with developing the circular economy and manufacturing. But we wanted to try to recycle lab plastic from universities.
Okay.
So we wanted to do a pilot scheme, and we wanted to take 50 kgs of plastic, recycle them, wash it, recycle it, and to produce a small pipette head out of the recycled plastic. Not that difficult. Mm-hmm. We just wanted to prove that we could do it. Because it was deemed a waste, we weren't allowed to move it from NUIG, because we didn't have a waste collection permit. So we had to get a waste company to collect it. They didn't want to collect 50 kgs, so they charged us a fortune for it. Yeah. Then we weren't allowed to wash it on the site we wanted to, because they didn't have the right waste permit. So we had to send it to Limerick. 50 kgs of material now, and all we're trying to do is to prove
that
we can wash that we can wash this. And we sent it down to Limerick to get it washed down there. We didn't have end of waste in Novaplast. At that stage, we were waiting 2 years for something from the EPA to get end of waste for our plastic. So it had to go to another site to be turned into a pellet, then sent to us. And then we sent it down to Athlone to make pipettes out of it. So these hurdles you have to jump through to try and do the right thing are crazy, you know. So we need to find a way to bypass a lot of this stuff. To make it easier to find solutions for recycling a lot of this material.
You mentioned the universities, and you mentioned at the start, you know, when you were qualifying, the amount of recycling work you did in university was next to nothing, right?
It was nothing.
Has that changed?
I don't think it has changed much, to be honest with you. The way they teach it hasn't, like they it's still in polymer engineering. They teach you how to make
plastics. How to recycle it.
Yeah, not really. And like it's a long time ago since I was in college. I don't like to tell many people how many years, but whenever I was down in Athlone, it was last year. And I had a slow realization that whenever I was in college, most of these kids weren't even born.
Yeah.
And still, we're still trying to teach people about recycling and what they should be doing. And I don't think they're doing a much better job at teaching how to recycle it, you know?
Which is probably a surprise or a disappointment, because chances are the mind of those students now are much more attuned to the idea of recycling.
They are, you know? They have research projects down there on recycling, but in terms of how they teach it, I don't think it has changed much at all, which is crazy when you think about it. Yeah, in this day and age.
I think I know the answer to this one, but we'll go anyway. Organic or acquired growth going forward?
So I need to be careful here. I took on private equity investment last year. And would I do it again? No, I wouldn't. And the idea was that we would invest both for organic and inorganic, because there are a lot of opportunities in the recycling industry. I think their expectations differ to mine, and mine differ to theirs also. But we're still together. We have a plan to move forward. And I suppose with the market being as it is at the moment, it probably doesn't make it any easier. But there's a lot of opportunity out there, not just in Ireland, outside of Ireland, to transplant what we do into other countries. We work with a lot of huge recyclers who have 3 or 4 recycling plants, and we take all their byproducts. Mm-hmm. And they would love to work with us and put in plants where they are, because bringing material from all around the world is not sustainable. So we need to get closer to our raw material sources, and that was part of the journey of bringing private equity in, as well as bringing in people that I thought could help me to run the business. And that's quite often not the case with private equity. They just want to put their money in and get it out 5 or 6 years later.
Take it out at
whatever
very much.
times x. So Because entrepreneurship is like it's a lonely place to be most of the time, you know. You're making decisions that a lot of people are relying on you to make the right decision every time, and that's not always possible. So that was a big part of me bringing in the private equity was to help me to run.
And if you had a do over, what would you do differently and in terms of the process with private equity?
The process itself of getting the money in was horrific as well. Like it's a tough process, but like looking back, I probably wouldn't have done it. I probably would have knuckled down, even though we were in a difficult year at the time. I probably just would have knuckled down and got on with it and just kept going. I think I might be better suited to a high net worth individual coming in maybe and somebody that you could work with and somebody who understands the day to day running of a business and what it takes to keep the show on the road might be better suited to me. That's not the case for everybody. Yeah. I know loads of friends who have brought on private equity and there's great stories there.
I suppose it ultimately shows you that it's horses for courses. Ultimately.
It is. Yeah, it is. I thought it was the panacea for us. But it didn't turn out that way, there are plenty there. Most people it works out for. They're probably at different stages in business, and
because
we were quite early. Yeah. We were coming out of a very good year financially in 2022, and we had one production line, and we did some good numbers and made some good money. And I put in a brand new production line to nearly double our capacity at the end of 2022, which we were pretty much able to finance ourselves at that stage. So it was an investment of 2.5 or 3 million euros. And I thought putting a second production line in would have my problems. But Jesus.
Doubled your problems.
Doubled my problems. I was trying to do everything in the same space that we had. So like space was at a premium, still is. You're increasing your headcount hugely. The market fell apart. And it was at the end of 2022 that I decided, you know, now's the time to bring in private equity because we're in a good place. We have a new production line. We have a good story to tell. But the market fell apart in 2023 and energy price was going through the roof because of Ukraine. So I should have pulled out of it then whenever I saw the writing was on the wall, because when you're explaining you're losing when it comes to private equity, you know, and we were explaining all year that it's just cyclical, it's going to come back, don't worry about it, but we'll get there in the end, you know. We have a plan in place with them and we to do some of the bigger projects that we have in mind over the next couple of years. One of them is like the one I spoke about earlier. It's huge. It needs a big equity check from both us and our partners that we're working on it. And I will probably need to bring in substantial capital to allow us to do that project, you know. So we'll see whether it's private equity or not. I'm not quite
Wait
so sure,
see.
But we'll see.
Has fear of failure ever been a driving force for you?
Hugely. Because I was all in with this project, you know. I worked for quite a while without any salary. And if Novelplast continues to fail, you know, it'd be a huge problem for me financially. So fear of failure has always been in the back of my mind. Plus, like, there are always people who are saying to you whenever you leave your job to go out into the entrepreneurship world, they say, do you know, what are you doing? Like, just, you know,
you
have no pension. What are you going to do?
You have
no salary for 6 months. So you want to prove them wrong. Even like I have an uncle in Switzerland who works he's a chemical engineer, and he worked in the PET world all his life for DuPont. And he thought I was mad for coming out of it to do something for myself, you know. So there's always a part of you that wants to prove people wrong, you know. And like Ireland is great, but like there's a lot of begrudgers in Ireland as well. You know,
the country's
full of them. And like I often think a lot of people would like to see entrepreneurs fail in Ireland, because you shouldn't be getting above your station too much, you know.
But you see, it's the funny thing about it is the people who want to see you fail would never be in your situation in the first place, right?
Yeah, you know, never. They want permanent pensionable.
Yeah, but the idea of being an entrepreneur is completely anathema to them, right?
Yeah,
and so therefore, I think anybody who does it is absolutely off the wall, you know. Yeah. But yet you look at it and you go, well, if entrepreneurs didn't do it through history, there'd be no companies full stop.
I know.
Somebody has to start.
Yeah, Ireland really needs entrepreneurs, you know. And like being part of the EY Entrepreneur of the Year program was a game changer for me, really. Like on a personal level, it was a game changer. And people just think it's about these awards and who's going to win the awards, but it's about so much more than that. Yeah. The awards are like they're nice to have, but they're not the need to have, but in the real thing. You make friends for life out of it, and just being able to hang around with other entrepreneurs, which I'd never done before. I remember going to the first Meet the Finalists night and I was thinking to myself, what the hell do entrepreneurs wear? Do you know? Because I didn't know. Like, and the answer is entrepreneurs wear whatever they want because they've other stuff to be worried about, you know?
Because they've probably come from the factory or something like that, or just rushing in.
Yeah, so I was overdressed that night. But being part of that program is huge for me, you know? And I get so much out of it every year. There's new finalists coming on board and like just learning about what they do, and it's not the stories of the big exits that inspire you. It's the stories of when people were down in the trenches, been days away from the business folding, and suddenly they rise from the ashes, and 10 years later they're selling for 50 million or 100 million or whatever it might be.
That only gets
they're the
headline.
Stories. Yeah. And there's like everyone has those stories in entrepreneurship where the end is just around the corner, you know, and that's what gets me up in the morning, and because quite often you have to, you know, you might have the worst day ever, and you need to dust yourself down the next morning and get ready to go again, and put on that brave face and make sure that people can't see what's going on behind the scenes. You know?
So then, why do you think is the most important personal characteristic of a CEO or an entrepreneur?
Like it has to be resilience. It has to be, like, you know, because if you don't have resilience as an entrepreneur, you won't. You'll be gone in 6 months, really. You have to be able to roll with those punches. And as I say, go to bed at night and get up in the morning and be ready to go again. Because it's a hard, hard road, and it's not for everybody, you know.
And what's the hardest part of being the CEO, do you think?
Good question. I'm not the best CEO in the world, and not even nearly. If I stayed in the private sector and I would never have become a CEO. It's just not for me. And the hardest part of it is having so many people reporting into you and different functions and
having so many plates in the air.
And I'm sure that's hard for them as well.
Yeah.
Do you know, it's hard for the team to be dealing with a character like me who can get distracted by things and who have I've always had my own way of doing things, and I still do, and they're not always the right way of doing things, but we get there in the end.
And who have you sought advice from since forming the business?
Good question. I'll be honest with you. I had a team of 12 from the EY Entrepreneur of the Year program came out to spend time with me there very recently to just to get fresh eyes on where the business is at the moment and what it needs, and because our turnover is kind of it's static for the last couple of years, and that old saying, "What got you here won't get you there," is we're living it at the moment, you know. And I was an eclectic bunch of entrepreneurs that came out to spend time, and it was a very, like, there was a lot of self-reflection, a lot of self-awareness, a lot of honesty about where the business is at the moment and about my style of running the business. And I won't tell you who they are, but you probably know at least half of them. You'd know them, you know, and they took a day out from their own busy schedules to come out to Gibbstown to the Gaeltacht and spend the day with me and came up with loads of advice, and we've our own WhatsApp group set up there, and going to visit a plant next week up in Northern Ireland with two of the team. So just been part of that EY Entrepreneur of the Year alumni is massive, because there's a bigger WhatsApp group that has about 600-700 people in it, and like all day, every day, people just fire stuff in, questions in. People who are trying to start up a business in the US, or they're starting to export product to the US, or medical device, or whatever it might be, because somebody else in there has been there and done it, you know. So from that respect, it's like you've easy access there to a lot of expertise. Or if you wanted an introduction to anybody in the UK or Ireland, you just stick it into that group and somebody will know them.
And I think it's a uniquely Irish thing, because we've seen it lots of times here. When that comes from, if you're looking for an introduction or you're looking to meet somebody, if you actually reach out to them, you know, there's very few people will say, no, I won't meet you for a cup of coffee, or no, I won't do this, or no, I won't do that.
If you come in through the right channel.
Absolutely. If the introduction's made, you go, listen, I'm looking at this, or whatever it is, that somebody will just go, no, I'm not telling you what that is.
And I find entrepreneurs are very giving of their time to try and help people, you know. Even the cohort that we had in 2023, it's an eclectic bunch of entrepreneurs. Mm. And we meet each other quite regularly, and we go out, and we have our nights out, and any of them, you could pick up the phone and ask them, or, you know, if you're having a problem, or get advice about private equity, or just the day-to-day running of the business, or whatever it might be. And you know, they'd be either on the end of the phone, or they'll be in the car, and they'll come up and see you. And you know, it's invaluable to have that. And you know, I would advise anyone who's listening and who's in business and is an entrepreneur to put their name forward, and don't be daunted by the name Entrepreneur of the Year. It's not about that, you know. It's about
the network that you get.
Your network is your net worth, as they say, and it's so true. And whenever it comes to that program, it really is. The 200 applications last year, and it's not the easiest program to get into, you know. But if you do get in, and even if you didn't get in the first year, keep applying. You know, there's no harm in it whatsoever. And hopefully someday you'll get that leg up, and it's hard to describe how good the program is for an entrepreneur who's on that journey, and as I said, it can be a lonely place.
How do you deal with setbacks?
I always have a plan B, and if somebody asked me to give them advice starting out, you can tell people you need to be resilient, you know. Yeah. But not everyone has that, but always have a plan B, and even today,
and plan C and plan D and plan E.
Do you know, you have to have it. One of the guys came to me today with a problem. There's a load of boxes coming over from the Netherlands for a project that I signed up for, because I find it difficult to say no, and we've no space in the place, and they're worried about where it's going to go, and rather than getting worried about it, you know, my mind is automatically thinking about, right, where are we going to put this stuff? You know, let's not lose the run of ourselves, you know, let's find solutions here. And there's always solutions to this stuff, and people probably think I'm quite calm all the time, you know. But I'm probably
inside the cogs are going.
Yeah,
going
I'm like a swan. I'm nice and calm on the outside, but underneath the legs are turning quite quickly.
Do you hate losing or love winning?
Oh, good question. I love winning. Really? I love winning. Yeah. Losing doesn't bother me that much. But I love winning, and I love banking the little wins that you have.
And do you celebrate the wins as an organization?
No, not really. We should do more, you know.
It's amazing the amount of entrepreneurs who are only ever looking forward. Eating bread is soon forgotten.
There's always something else to move on to, you know. Yeah. But I don't sweat the small stuff either. Some people say you should sweat them, but you know, you have enough to be worried about.
That's another question I often ask. Do you obsess about the small things?
Don't. We move on because you have enough to be worried about in life, either in your personal life or elsewhere. Yeah. Do you know, you have enough going on to be worried about the small stuff.
We had a good answer from one guest. He said, I only obsess about the small things when they're the important things.
Yeah. You know? And so typically when they're small, they're not, you know?
But he says sometimes it's big things and they're not important, even though it seems big, but they're not actually important. Yeah. But some small things, he said, they can be really, really important. Yeah.
There's a lot to be said for it, you know? You know? Because it's stressful, there's...
But you've only a certain amount of mental spectrum that you can fill up.
Do you know? Because it's an emotional journey as well,
When it comes to decision making, are you fast or slow?
Fast, probably to my detriment sometimes, I would say. Fast.
Okay. And given your background, I'm going to be interested in this one. When you make your decisions, are they data-based or gut feel?
Gut feel.
As an engineer?
Yeah.
How is that?
Like in the early days, they would have been data-based. But now it's gut feel. I make decisions quite quickly and I don't always get them right, but
it's funny because my brother's a chemical engineer,
right?
And he is completely data based. If I want to convince him something, just give him a set of data. There you go. He goes, oh yeah, that's fine. Job done.
No, that wouldn't be me now. And it's probably to my detriment as well, you know, because then somebody could ask me the same question a month later, and you know, there might be some other data in my head that might cause me to change my mind, you know, but I certainly try to make them fast and move on.
How do you feel about what you've already done in the company?
We have a lot to do.
Okay.
We have a lot to do, you know, we've gone from zero revenue up to I think about 14, 15 million last year, you know, but we've been stagnant for a couple of years. I think I have another good 5-6 years left in me of doing the hard hours. I've a lot more to do, I think, in the industry and in the business before I think about hanging up my boots or even, I would say hanging them up, but hanging them up part-time at least, you know.
And on that basis then, do you have an exit strategy in your head? Or have you even thought about it?
Of course you think about it. And, you know, you think about the big exit, but I've ideas for other startups in my head, bringing in the private equity. I thought, you know, we'll make the exit in 5 years, but then I've these other projects and the big one is it will be 5 years before it even gets off the ground, you know. Mm. So I've a bit to play out, and quite a lot
would
of
you,
people.
Would you see all of that within the Novaplast sphere, or are they distinct businesses to that?
So most of them within the Novaplast sphere. Okay. Yeah. I often come up with other ideas that are completely out of my comfort zone. I haven't run with any of those just yet.
Just yet.
Yeah. When people say with entrepreneurs, whenever they sell their business, you're at a loose end. Like if you don't have a plan for what to do next, there'll always be a what's next. You know, it's just the way.
People forget that you've been doing 16 hours a day for seven days a week.
Yeah, yeah.
That's an awful lot of hours to fill if you're not doing the 16 hours a day.
Retirement is probably getting a job at 5 days a week. You know, would be nice for a while.
Ease back ever so slightly. Right, the black book time. Let's see what we have installed for you. I can quite honestly say we've never had this question or anywhere close to it, right? And your question is, were you looking forward to today's podcast or absolutely terrified?
I was kind of looking forward to it. I enjoy doing, I've done a few podcasts before, right. Wasn't terrified at all.
And do you like talking about the business?
I do. I enjoy talking about it, you know. There's a message that needs to get out there about recycling and about how we look after things and sustainability and circular economy. And the more people that are talking about it, the better. The more people that are listening, the better. So so I do enjoy talking about it, yeah.
Right, well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Neil Skeffington. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks and we'll see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.